And then God opened her heart to the point where she finally responded in faith. This was a wonderful verse about the sovereignty of God in the process of salvation. Taking a person who is dead in trespasses and sin, but taking this person and by His grace, opening their heart to be able to hear and respond ultimately to the gospel of Christ. The ability to respond to the gospel, ladies and gentlemen, was not created by you. It was the process of a gracious God who pried your dead heart open.
Salvation is an act of God, and He offers it to us as a gift. In the book of Acts, we read of two women who have very little in common. One is a wealthy businesswoman. The other is a dirt-poor, demon-possessed girl. But the one thing they have in common is that they both need the Savior. And so do you. Welcome to Wisdom for the Heart. We're continuing through our Vintage Wisdom series from the book of Acts, and we come to a lesson today entitled, A Tale of Two Women. Our Bible teacher, Stephen Davey, is going to open God's Word to you and explore the gospel and how the gospel comes to those who desperately need it. Here's Stephen with today's lesson.
85 years ago, the floating city set sail on its maiden voyage from England to New York City. It's gotten a lot of attention in this anniversary year. The most luxurious vessel ever built by man, because of its double hull and 16 watertight compartments, it was considered unsinkable. It was April 14th, I have read, on Sunday, when the Titanic approached the North Atlantic ice fields, traveling too fast, trying to set a speed record, transatlantic record. They found themselves heading straight for a small mountain of ice. Orders were given to turn to port, and they did just in time, contrary to popular opinion, to avoid a head-on collision. And yet that may have been unfortunate, because beneath the surface, that iceberg went to work, and like a knife through hot butter, it sliced an opening in that double hull, not even an inch wide, but 300 feet long. A lady by the name of Eva Hart was recently interviewed, and the reporter whose article I read a few days ago, she told the story of that horrific night where she, as a 7-year-old, was quickly loaded onto one of the 20 lifeboats that the ship carried. Way too few lifeboats, but when you're unsinkable, you don't need them. Women and children were given the order to board first, and that's all that made it. Among others, she said that that night revealed the character of people probably like nothing else could. Some people knelt and prayed. She said some people joined hands and began to sing hymns. Others who were more cowardly, men who had heard the order come that only women and children could board a lifeboat, slipped back into staterooms and donned women's apparel to try to fool those crewmen and make their way onto the life-saving boat. The Titanic sank, claiming 1,500 lives. The story behind that story that is not as well known is that there was another vessel 20 miles away, known as the Californian. This large vessel was capable of saving all those who would drown. The trouble is, as the Titanic sent out its distress signal time after time after time again, it was never heard, because the radio operator at the Californian had fallen asleep on duty. By the time the message was received, it was too late to save but a few. In Acts chapter 16, a cry for help comes across the Aegean Sea. It came from Europe, a continent mired in idolatry, barbarians roaming the German forests, inundated with self-serving mankind. And the call for help came in the night to someone who happened to be listening. And we looked at that call, but let's go back to verse 9, where this man is standing and appealing to Paul and saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." Like a flare fired in the darkest night, this call comes to the apostle, and immediately he knows that it is God's design for him to form a rescue party and head for Europe. In fact, the next verse, verse 10, said when he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. History would be made because of that. Verse 11, therefore, putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace and on the day following Neapolis, and from there to Philippi. This would be the first city on European soil that he ministers to. He said it was a leading city in the district of Macedonia. It was also a Roman colony. And we were staying in this city for some days. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. These verses, by the way, tell us a lot about the spiritual condition of Philippi. Jewish law required that if any village or city was inhabited by at least 10 Jewish men, that these men were under obligation to form a synagogue. The fact that this place of prayer was by the river out in the open reveals that there then are less than 10 men of Jewish origin, or perhaps worse yet, 10 men of Jewish origin faithless to the God of Israel to form a synagogue. Furthermore, once you arrive at the place of prayer, I was struck, and perhaps you were as well, that only women have assembled. No men. This sends us a rather strong message about Paul. He was a former Pharisee, and his attitude toward women had remarkably changed because of the gospel. It's significant that the first people Paul ever preached to in Europe were women. J. Vernon McGee once quipped, "Evidently the man from Macedonia was a woman." You need to understand that in this culture, women were not ministered to the scriptures to like men were. In fact, the rabbis of Paul's day looked down on the female gender. And they would actually write, and we have copies of this writing, where the rabbis taught, quote, "It is better that the words of the law be burned than delivered to a woman." The Pharisee, and Paul was a former Pharisee, would rise each morning and through his daily ritual, he would eventually pray the prayer that Paul probably prayed as a former Pharisee. "God, I thank thee that I was not born a Gentile, a slave, or a woman." What changed Paul's attitude toward women? The gospel of Jesus Christ. You read his writings and you discover that women are given honor and dignity. It is the Bible and its teaching that does that. Compare us to countries without the gospel and you will see women occupying the roles of beasts of burden, enslaved to reproduction. So as Paul arrives in Europe and goes down to the riverside, you don't see him repack his bags and give some kind of lame apology and walk away once he discovers that only women have appeared. It says that he sat down. That's the form that a rabbi took. He sat down and began to teach, deliver the gospel to these faithful women whom God will use to impact their city. I might dare say that in most cities, it is the women who belong to God that make any impact at all. You could make the same cry today that you could make back at Philippi. Where are the godly men? Well, they weren't here. And so he delivers it to the women who were ready and open. Notice verse 14. And a certain woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening. Now, for the expositor, you don't appreciate a sentence like that because there's too much in it to really go very far without slicing it up. Let's stop just long enough to deal with the volume of information that we're given about this woman. She was a dealer in or a seller of purple fabrics. This job, you need to understand, was as lucrative as any business in America that's lucrative. Purple dye applied to fine linen would be like owning the microchip patent for fine computers. That's because the purple dye was extracted from a shellfish, and it would take 8,000 shellfish to come up with 1 gram of purple dye. So this was incredibly expensive clothing. You could call this the Lexus of wardrobes. Purple garments would be worn by the emperor. In fact, every Roman senator had his customary white toga, and it was trimmed in purple. Private citizens wore their purple to reveal their immense wealth to the adoring, coveting populace. And Lydia was evidently the middleman here. She's the broker in the operation that stretches all the way back to Asia Minor and into Europe, and she was immensely wealthy. Discovered as well by the implication that she is capable of inviting 4 men to live on her estate. She has enough servants and food and accommodations to handle that just like that. She had profited tremendously by this industry. But the text also tells us that she wasn't happy with all that she had, because she was a worshiper of God. You could render that a God-fearer. That's a special term that appears in the New Testament for the Gentile that had abandoned the idolatry of their countrymen and followed after the one and only God of Israel. They really weren't Gentile and they really weren't Jew. They were sort of caught in the middle, but they knew that this wasn't satisfying. They knew that the Jews followed the true God, and so in the light they were given, they became God-fearers. And so here you have this wealthy woman meeting in a very primitive setting, perhaps sitting on the ground with other women, praying to the God of Israel. Now, the last part of verse 14 tells us, as Paul was speaking and teaching, that she was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. Great, great verse of Scripture. The verb tense here tells us that Paul spoke several times to her. That it wasn't at the first meeting that God opened her heart. It was after several meetings. And then God opened her heart to the point where she finally responded in faith. This is a wonderful verse about the sovereignty of God in the process of salvation. Taking a person who is dead in trespasses and sin, a person who cannot respond to external stimuli, but taking this person and by his grace opening their heart to be able to hear and respond ultimately to the gospel of Christ. The ability to respond to the gospel, ladies and gentlemen, was not created by you. It was not your process. It was the process of a gracious God who pried your dead heart open. This verse tells us that even before Lydia believed, God was behind it all, opening her heart in order that she might believe. And I want to say this. If your heart doesn't respond to the word, if there isn't any impulse within you that finds interest in the words spoken by Paul and all of these epistles, if you can take his church or leave it, if you can take God or leave it, if there is no inward motivation to serve Christ and his church, no desire to honor him, you may be spiritually dead. That is, there are no signs of life. And you ought to be terrified enough to get on your knees and beg God to open your heart, because as you look at your life, there are no vital signs of spirituality. And you can't open your heart. You can't wake up one morning and say, I think I'll believe. God has to do that. Maybe you need to beg him to. Notice the first phrase of verse 15. It tells us then that she not only believed, but she and her household had been baptized. Now notice the latter part of verse 15. She urged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay. And she prevailed upon us. Now that tells us that Paul first declined.
No, we really shouldn't do that. We don't want to impose. No, you stay. She's probably the kind of woman that when she had her mind made up, things happen. And so she prevailed upon them, and her house became the base of ministry for the work of God as it began to multiply from Philippi on into European territory. I find it interesting here that this woman was willing to connect her business success with the propagation of the gospel. Her home, which was the thriving corporate center of her business, now becomes part and parcel with the work and ministry of this evangelistic team. Her resources are now at the disposal of Paul and his team. And I had to, as I read this, just ask the question, where is the president of the companies in this city, in this country? Where are the CEOs? Where are the owners of businesses who've made this connection? Lydia saw the connection, and her business became the base of operations in reaching into Europe. Now, the text goes on to introduce us to another woman involved in a lucrative business. Her business was involved with the underworld, however, literally, the world of demons and divination. Look at verse 16. And it happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, a certain slave girl, having a spirit of divination, met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune tellers. Now, there are a number of good expositors and commentators who believe that her masters were actually priests from the local temple, the temple of Apollo. And I'll throw my hat in the ring with them because of the word in the Greek text, divination, translated there, divination. It comes from the Greek word puthana, which transliterated gives us the word python. The spirit of divination can be rendered the spirit of python. And this, of course, then opens the door to what we've come to learn, this practice of religion that was part of Greek mythology. Apollo supposedly spoke through the python that guarded the special sanctuary or the oracle of Delphi. And in this day, Romans didn't do anything without predictions of the future. And so anybody who was able to predict the future in Paul's day was called someone who was led by the serpent. Can you imagine that? I believe, as in this day, those who supposedly could tell the future were indeed being led by and are being led by the serpent. Now notice what she's doing. Verse 17, she's following after Paul and us, and she kept crying and saying, "These men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." Now, what's wrong with that? You know, my first glance was that sounds like great free advertising. Here's someone who's known throughout the community for predicting the future, and now she's basically saying, "You have arrived on our soil and shores, servants of the Most High God." She's saying, listen to them. They're proclaiming to you a way of salvation. That isn't the truth. They are proclaiming the way of salvation. And to those Europeans, she's suggesting they just take this way and stuff it in the bag with all the other ways. And maybe they'll be saved one day. So this isn't free advertising. Far from it. Finally, Paul had enough. Verse 18, she continued doing this for many days. Can't get rid of this gal. Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out at that very moment. But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. I like Luke's sense of humor here. Verse 18, he says, the demon came out, exelthen, literally the demon exited. And he uses the same word in verse 19. Her master saw that their hope of profit had exited. Demon exited, their hope of profit exited. Same word. Now they really get agitated. See, it's okay for her to run around day after day after day after day. Say, these are servants of the Most High God. And listen to them, they're proclaiming a way of salvation. Oh, but now they're bothered. And they will haul these men into court, as we'll see in a moment, and they will be beaten and placed in the jail. See, they get agitated when their prophet exited. Up until then, it was okay. Now, we're going to have to leave our story at this point. But for now, let's take a close look at this narrative and make application by way of studying the contrast between those led by the serpent and those led by the Spirit. First of all, what we can pull from this passage is that those led by the serpent had a blindness to spiritual significance. Here's Paul exercising power over Apollo. This is front page news. And he mentions his power in relation to this name, Jesus Christ. If you had been the master of this girl and you knew the demon was gone and the ability to predict the future, thus saying that the God that these men were following is more powerful than your God, wouldn't you stop and ask, what's going on here? Who is this Jesus Christ? You never hear that. They never ask a question. Why? Because those who follow the serpent cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to them. Neither can they understand them, for they are spiritually discerned. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Those, however, by contrast, who are led by the Spirit, there is an acceptance of truth. As observed in what happens next, Lydia, Lady Lydia, endured, I'm sure, the stares of her countrymen as she walked into that river with her purple gowns on. What an odd sight. But she openly accepted the truth that led her to salvation, and now she's identifying with those who are saved in this outward way. Next, those who are led by the serpent, there is a greedy clutching no matter what it does to others. We don't care about this servant girl. We don't care that we're wasting and ruining her life. We don't care about these strangers. Haul them off to court and beat them and throw them into prison. Do away with them. We don't care. Yet Lydia, by way of contrast, a very wealthy woman, exemplifies sharing for the sake of others. Here's my home, my food, my servants. For those led by the serpent, they deceitfully cloak their true motives. Look at verse 20. When they had brought them to the chief magistrates, they said, "These men are throwing our city into confusion. Being Jews," they just sort of insert that, "and are proclaiming customs which are not lawful for us to accept or to observe, we being Romans." Just like the serpent, these followers of the serpent disguise their true motive under the garb of national pride. We're concerned for the customs of the Roman emperor. The truth here is nothing more than crass greed. Their heart was in their wallet, and Paul had picked their wallets clean. Christianity is tolerated until it adversely impacts profitability, and then it is no longer acceptable. In contrast, however, those led by the Spirit have an honest confession, an honest character before others. Finally, those led by the serpent have their citizenship in and loyalty to earth. You remember I mentioned earlier that Philippi was a Roman colony? We don't have a lot of time, but let me just tell you that that meant they promoted the Roman way of life. They gave Rome a loyal base abroad. This was the European base, at least near the coast, for Rome. The colonists were proud ambassadors of the Roman way of life. They honored the Roman emperor. They followed Roman law. They were proud, as these men say here, to be Romans. Their allegiance was to Rome. The highest hope was to advance in the kingdom of Rome. They are among the colonists of Rome. Those who are led by the Spirit have their citizenship in and their loyalty to heaven. You know what that means? Paul would write to the Philippian church in chapter 3, verse 20. He would say, your citizenship is in heaven. Moffat translates it, our colony is heaven. What that means is that those led by the Spirit give honor to the Emperor of heaven. We advance the cause of heaven. We are proud to be ambassadors of heaven. Our greatest honor will be to be given responsibility in the kingdom of heaven. But it has everything to do with the one that you are following. And so in the final chapter of this epistle to the Philippian church, Paul, writing to Christians, mind you, says to them, listen, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is gracious, whatever is of good reputation, if there is excellence in any of those things, ponder these things. The next verse says, practice these things. He's telling believers, make up your mind. Will you be led by the alluring siren sound of the serpent and live for the colony of earth? Or will you follow the voice of the Spirit of God and live for the kingdom of heaven?
Thanks for joining us today for this powerful lesson from the book of Acts. This is Wisdom for the Heart, and we've gone back to our archives to bring you this vintage wisdom series. Stephen first taught these lessons to the church he pastors many years ago, but the truth is still relevant today. I hope you were encouraged by today's lesson and that you'll be with us in the days ahead as we continue through this series. Our next lesson in the series will be tomorrow, but between now and then, we'd love to interact with you. Wisdom for the Heart is on social media, and that's a great way for you to follow what's happening in our ministry and be aware of any special offers. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have a comment or a question for Stephen, or if you want to send him a note of encouragement, you can write to us at Wisdom for the Heart, P.O. Box 37297, Raleigh, North Carolina, 27627. I hope we hear from you. We have a staff and volunteer team in the office to answer your phone calls if you'd like to call and speak with us directly. We'd be especially interested in telling you about our newest resource, Heart to Heart Magazine. This is a monthly magazine containing articles and a daily devotional guide. We'd like to tell you more about that if you call us today at 866-48-BIBLE. I'm Scott Wiley, and I thank you for joining us. Be with us tomorrow for more Wisdom for the Heart.